Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carolyn Fredrickson of the ACLU, who examines new documents which reveal the involvement of the Pentagon in government surveillance of U.S. progressive activist groups. Zhao Da Silva, communications coordinator with School of the Americas Watch, who discusses the 16th annual protest at Fort Benning, Georgia, as part of the ongoing effort to close the Pentagon school that has trained Latin American human rights abusers. And Holly Jacobson, co-director of the group Voter Action, who takes a critical look at voting irregularities in Florida's 13th congressional district, where an estimated 18,000 ballots were lost in an extremely tight race. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Hours before the signing of a historic peace accord in Nepal, ending a 10-year civil war which has killed 13,000 people, monitors for the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights and the UN Children's Fund warned leaders of Maoist rebels that international law forbids the recruitment of children under 18 into armed groups. As part of the peace deal, rebels had agreed to go to 7 camps and disarm in front of UN monitors. According to the Interpress Service, the left-wing army was still recruiting child soldiers. The Maoist faction insists it was attempting to get youth to join its political party. In 2005, Maoists joined a broad coalition of opposition parties to oust King Gyanendra, who had seized power and forced out the Prime Minister. In April, after hundreds of thousands of people protested in the streets, the king relented and recalled Parliament. The rebels and the interim government observed a 6-month ceasefire before signing the peace accord. A high-level commission had concluded that the king and 201 associates should be prosecuted for repressing the mass protests which resulted in 19 deaths. The Maoists will now join the transitional government, leading to a new election which will determine if the 238-year-old monarchy will be preserved or scrapped. The accord also calls for Nepal to establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Roberto Marcos Garcia was the third journalist killed in Mexico during the month of November. An assistant editor for a weekly paper in Veracruz, Garcia was killed after returning from interviewing water quality enforcement officials. According to Reporters Without Borders, Garcia, a crime reporter, was knocked off his motorcycle by a car and shot with a 9mm gun. In mid-November, Misael Tamayo Hernandez, the editor of the daily El Desperado de la Costa, was found dead in a hotel room with puncture wounds to his shoulder. The coroner said he died of a heart attack. Hernandez's family and co-workers went looking for him after he failed to attend an evening meeting at the newspaper. The death of Garcia and Hernandez was linked to Mexico's powerful drug gangs, making the Latin American nation the second most deadliest place for a journalist besides Iraq. Brad Will, an American freelance reporter, was also killed by undercover police in the ongoing conflict in the city of Oaxaca. According to the Los Angeles Times, over 2,000 people have died this year in battles among drug gangs in Mexico, including 7 journalists. Just days before his death, Hernandez wrote a column denouncing local corruption. The state of Guerrero, which includes Acapulco, is under siege by rival drug gangs and the local police. The taser stun gun is growing in popularity amongst local law enforcement as a so-called non-lethal method of incapacitating suspects. But the taser is involved in a growing number of deadly incidents, with 200 taser-related deaths since 2001 and 50 deaths so far in 2006. In one case last August, Ryan Wilson was hit by an X-26 taser by police in Lafayette, Colorado, after he ran half a mile to escape arrest. The 22-year-old man fell to the ground, convulsed, and soon died, despite attempts at cardiopulmonary resuscitation by police. According to the news magazine In These Times, advanced taser technology in the late 1990s enabled police to shoot 50,000 volts through a human body. The weapon is designed to override a person's nervous system and disable them. The X-26 taser can be mounted to a rifle and is being used in this manner in Iraq. Civil rights groups are complaining about the abuse of taser technology in state and local prisons. In a lawsuit, the ACLU of Colorado claims the stun gun is used to torture inmates along with electroshock belts, restraint chairs, and pepper spray. In October 2005, the Police Executive Research Forum, a policy research and advocacy group, recommended strict limits on taser use, shooting them only at suspects, aggressively resisting arrest, and exempting altogether specific groups like the mentally ill. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Over the last several years, the American Civil Liberties Union and other human rights groups have gathered evidence confirming that the FBI has monitored the activities of U.S. civil liberties, anti-war, and environmental organizations. A lawsuit brought by these groups forced the Justice Department to reveal more than 3,500 pages of documents detailing the surveillance undertaken against groups and individuals critical of the Bush administration. Under a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, the ACLU has recently obtained additional documents which show that government counterterrorism agencies were used to spy on anti-war groups as they engaged in meetings, protests, and counter-recruitment activity. The Pentagon's Threat and Local Observation Notice, or TALON program, spied on groups such as Veterans for Peace, which have engaged in lawful political activity at military recruitment stations and on college campuses. Nevertheless, government undercover agents surveilled or infiltrated these organizations while recognizing their peaceful conduct, but noting that their activity could in the future become a threat to U.S. military personnel. Thus far, the Republican-controlled Congress has refused to investigate why government agencies are spying on Americans, exercising their free speech rights, and where this information has been disseminated. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Caroline Fredrickson, director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, who discusses the significance of this new batch of documents and her group's call for the incoming Congress to conduct an aggressive investigation into the Bush administration's spying on domestic political groups.
The government has gone to great lengths to actually infiltrate some of these groups, and they have been collecting information about a range of organizations and individuals, primarily those who are engaged in peaceful protest, sometimes against the war and sometimes for the environment or other issues, including Quakers, Greenpeace, American Indian Movement, and others, all sorts of groups that are not terrorist threats, that are simply acting out their First Amendment rights. We have a whole series of FOIA requests in, and we have been looking specifically for the FBI files on groups and individuals who've been targeted for speaking out. And we've also been trying to find out information about the actual structure and policies of the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, which the FBI has been using as the vehicle for this kind of surveillance. And those are basic sort of memoranda of understandings or agreements with local police and law enforcement agencies to engage in spying in their local communities.
As the government surveils these organizations and, as you said, in some cases infiltrating them, what is the information gathered used for? Do we know that?
Well, you know, we don't really know that, and that's something we really need to find out. It's of a piece with the entire surveillance work that this administration has been doing. They have so many different programs. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. They have the National Security Agency, and the Defense Department obviously has been engaging in spying, the FBI. And all of these different entities in the government are gathering information on Americans engaging in lawful activity. And to what end is the exact question that needs to be asked and answered? And we are putting a lot of pressure on Congress, as well as the courts, to take up that question and try and seek the answers that the American people deserve to know.
Tell us a little bit about some of the groups that were targeted in this latest round of documents revealed by the government with your FOIA requests. I know among them were Veterans for Peace, but maybe go into some other details about what we know about the groups targeted.
Well, you know, it has been a range of groups that have been specifically engaged in anti-war protests, and United for Peace and Justice is one of the groups, the Quakers, as I mentioned before. What's really troubling is that here we have the process of democracy working when people can go out and demonstrate how they feel about the actions taken by their government and have their First Amendment rights protected and honored. And in this case, what we have is the government trying to keep track of that and ultimately perhaps shut it down. And where that information is going and what's being done with it is a key piece of this that needs to be explored. Because I think what people need to understand is that these entities, particularly the FBI, has a very sordid history of engaging in surveillance on individuals who've simply been raising their voices about troubling social problems. For example, Martin Luther King was a subject of extensive surveillance by the FBI. Any number of political activists in the 60s, civil rights leaders, and people who protested against the Vietnam War. And this is just the same sort of behavior that we had thought we repudiated in the past and put restrictions on the FBI, and now it seems that they're back at it.
Caroline, a new Congress will be sworn into office this January. The Democrats will control both the House and Senate. What is it that you're advocating the new Congress do in regard to investigating what the government has done on this surveillance of peaceful political organizations?
Well, you know, as you mentioned before, there is a big question about what's been done with this information. And there's a big question about how these policies got put in place and who has been in charge of directing the gathering of information. And that ranges from the FBI to the Department of Defense to the National Security Agency and so forth. There is a lot to look into, unfortunately. So one of the major things that Congress really needs to do is figure out what's happened with the information. Where has it been going and how has it been used and has it been abused? Civil rights leaders, war protesters, peaceful activists have been under surveillance by a variety of American governments over our history. And sometimes that information was used to very detrimental ends and was very harmful to people's careers, was very harmful to their lives overall. And so that's an important question that Congress needs to answer. Has the information that's been gathered been used for purposes that have been harmful to the people who've been under surveillance? Then we need to know how that information is being protected. How is it being kept? How is it being shared? These are profound and difficult questions that Congress needs to get to the bottom of, because without that, this administration has set in motion the possibility that we are all really the subjects of ongoing permanent surveillance in a society that's in a permanent and ongoing war on terror, and that our information about our most private, intimate details of our lives are going to be kept in databases and shared among different government agencies and potentially with the private sector if the government so determines.
That was Caroline Fredrickson, director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office. Contact the ACLU by calling area code 212-549-2500. Visit the group's website at www.aclu.org to view the government's surveillance documents. On the third weekend in November, an estimated 20,000 people gathered outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, to call for the closure of the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC, formerly known as the School of the Americas. Participants came from all over the country to bear witness to the tens of thousands of Latin American civilians who have been killed and often tortured with the complicity of their nation's military graduates of the school. The activists' goal is to close the school either by cutting its funding or by draining the pool of soldiers from countries throughout Latin America, which send 1,000 students to attend classes at the school every year. In recent years, the largest number of soldiers at WINSEC have come from Colombia, followed by Mexico. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with João da Silva, communications director with School of the Americas Watch, the organization founded by Mary Noel Priest, Father Roy Bourgeois, in 1990, after several priests, who were close friends of his, were murdered by soldiers in El Salvador. He discusses the increasing collaboration between SOA Watch, human rights groups, and progressive political leaders in Latin America. He also describes his group's campaign to pass legislation in the U.S. Congress that would close the school, which got a boost after 20 congressional supporters of WINSEC lost their bid for re-election in November.
While the events take place here in Fort Benning, Georgia, there are events going on in seven more countries simultaneously over the weekend. Those countries are Chile, Argentina, Ecuador, Paraguay, El Salvador, Colombia, Bolivia. And we're really excited because these are all things that are taking place to protest militarism in Latin America and U.S. foreign policy, and also to protest for the closure of the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, which was formerly known as the School of the Americas.
Because of elections of left-of-center heads of state in several Latin American countries, the latest being Rafael Correa in Ecuador just this past week, has there been any progress made in getting these countries not to send soldiers to Fort Benning to be trained?
Yes. Well, one of the first countries to stop sending troops to the SOA WINSEC was Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. Then shortly after, they were followed by Argentina and Uruguay. They made the decision to stop sending troops to the SOA because they felt that the past events, the things that the SOA represented and in a way influenced events in those countries, did not agree with their national politics. The government of Bolivia is very friendly to the cause, of course, since Evo Morales was elected, and he is also, you know, a survivor of repression and human rights abuse under Hugo Banzer's government, who is a graduate of the SOA. They've also talked about gradually removing troops from the SOA WINSEC, and the same thing was said by the Minister of Defense in Chile, who said she would recommend the military to stop sending troops to the SOA. The issue is that the militaries in South America still hold a lot of power and a lot of influence, so it's very challenging to propose to leaders of these nations to demand from their militaries to stop sending troops.
So let's talk a little bit about the SOA Watch's evaluation of the U.S. elections that took place earlier this month.
Sure. Well, in the last vote in the House, the vote to close the SOA, which was in H.R. 1217, this bill which was a reform to U.S. military and financial aid to Latin America, one of the important things is that the bill lost by 15 votes. If you consider that the House and Senate were controlled by a Republican majority, it was a very good win, and I think we didn't expect to get as many votes as we did. I think that now that 20 of the people who opposed that bill are gone, have left the House, I think that this gives us a really good chance this year. Representative Jim McGovern has mentioned that he will once again push Bill H.R. 1217 this year. The vote was in the House and never reached the Senate, and we're hoping that it will reach the Senate this year.
João de Silva, given that in the last year there's been more information coming out about U.S. condoned torture, and now with the passage of the Military Commissions Act by Congress, which has given legal cover to all the things the Bush administration had been doing illegally, do you think these developments have helped build support for closing the SOA WINSEC?
Definitely. I think that, you know, ever since the Abu Ghraib scandal and the Guantanamo scandal, people have become much more aware of the issue of torture and of human rights abuse. It seemed for a lot of years that the mass audience had sort of forgotten about that, that they had forgotten that that had gone on in Latin America and it was so commonplace throughout the 70s and 80s. I think that that really energized a lot of people. And I think also the general discontent, you know, for all the wars we're taking part of, all these ongoing threats from the government to, you know, attack Korea or start another war with Iran. And this is just a very, I'd say, a very gloomy situation. It's a very dark moment in history right now.
How do you explain how thousands of people take 3 or 4 days out of their lives to go there when the focus really needs to be on follow-up with their elected officials to cut funding for the school?
I think for the fact that people come all the way here every year is because they also realize that we've had Democratic and Republican governments come and go for the past 50 years, but in those 50 years, U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America has not really changed. And I think that people realize that and realize that we can't always expect the legislative and government to always solve all of our problems. And they are not going to listen to us unless we show that the movement is this big, that we prove to them that there's a large amount of support, that there's a big grassroots movement in action.
That was João de Silva of School of the Americas Watch. For more information, visit the group's website at www.soaw.org or call their office at 202 202- 1-800-234-3440. In Florida, the home of contested elections, the state's 13th congressional district is the focus of growing national attention after election results there November 7th revealed some 18,000 missing ballots. Initial vote totals had Republican Vern Buchanan with a razor-thin edge of only 368 votes over his opponent, Democrat Christine Jennings, in the former district of controversial Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris. But after a required recount, the Jennings campaign grew suspicious when they found that more than 18,000 ballots cast in Sarasota County had not included a vote in the House race. Many voters interviewed by the local press said they believed that votes cast on ES&S electronic touchscreen machines had not accurately counted their votes. Because these voting machines have no paper trail, there is no method of locating or recounting the missing ballots. According to the Sarasota Herald Tribune, if the lost votes had broken for Jennings by the same percentage as others cast in the county, the Democratic candidate would have won the race by about 600 votes. Christine Jennings is contesting the result, and along with a group of Sarasota County voters, has filed a suit demanding a new election. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Holly Jacobson, co-founder and co-director of the group Voter Action, which has called for a formal, independent investigation of the flaws in the 13th District's electronic voting machinery. She explains why getting all the facts in this contested Florida election could help safeguard the integrity of future elections across the nation.
The problem with the 18,000 undervotes is it's a very high undervote rate, but the high undervote rate occurs on electronic voting machines. So in some precincts, that undervote rate on electronic voting machines is up to 31%. But when people from those same precincts cast their votes on absentee ballots, paper ballots, it was down to 2%. So when you have a discrepancy like that, it says there's probably something wrong.
There were interviews conducted by local newspapers with voters who cast their ballots in that district on those electronic voting machines. And what do these interviews reveal about the problems that people saw on the voting screens of those election machines?
Originally it was thought to be, it was kind of cast off as a ballot design error, kind of the modern touchscreen version of the hanging chad. Well, we didn't design the ballot correctly. But in fact, what we found through numerous interviews that we've conducted in Sarasota, and these are interviews with Democratic and Republican voters alike, it's not just a screen design problem. Some voters found the race originally, but then when they went to the review screen at the very end to cast their final vote, the Jennings-Buchanan race disappeared, or their vote for Jennings disappeared. We also found that there were numbers of switched votes, which is pushed on one candidate and another popped up. So we're looking at a variety of problems that have come forward. The citizens of Sarasota really need to be congratulated because regardless of partisan affiliation, they are very upset about this as voters, as citizens. They want all votes to count. And we have Republicans who voted for Buchanan who are furious about this situation.
Now, given that there's only a 300-some-odd vote difference between the two candidates, the Democrat and Republican, what are the various stances of each candidate?
The Jennings campaign filed a revote contest. They're asking the courts for a revote. Really, they can't go and recover those 18,000 votes on the electronic voting machine because they're just gone. They were never recorded. They did a recount initially, which was rather meaningless because it's basically pushing the same buttons, and we knew it would produce the same results, and sure enough, it did. There were 18,000 undervotes in the congressional race in Sarasota County. So the Jennings campaign has asked for a revote and an audit. Voter Action filed a lawsuit last Tuesday also asking for a revote and an independent audit and investigation. And we feel that kind of bringing a nonpartisan viewpoint to this is needed. We don't believe that the state is able to do that on their own because the same people that certify the voting equipment that are going to be reviewing the voting equipment for the state of Florida. It's also probably important to point out, Scott, that you know, Sarasota County wasn't the only county plagued by high undervote problems. And three surrounding counties in Florida, there were also high undervote problems, not in the congressional race, but in for the attorney general. And we've seen ES&S electronic voting machines across the country in this past election and before create many problems. In Texas, in this election, it created ES&S electronic software created about 11,000 overvotes, what we call phantom votes. That's more votes than voters. Undervotes and missing votes and switch votes also plagued Arkansas and Pennsylvania and Ohio. So what's happening is all eyes are focused on Sarasota, which is good because it's getting a lot of attention. But we also know that this is not a unique or one-time phenomenon. This is happening all over the country. It's completely underreported by the media, and we need to get a grasp on it. And that's the opportunity that Sarasota presents.
When you look at the problems nationally with electronic voting machines, is there a patch here? Is there a fix that can be made that will guarantee the veracity of our elections in the future, or do you think we have to scrap these machines?
Well, you know, we're Americans. We always want a patch or a quick fix, and I'm afraid that what we've seen so far, the evidence points that there's no way to fix these systems as they exist now. Well, I'm old-fashioned. I believe that public officials who are not lobbied by election companies should be running our elections with a lot of oversight from the citizens. You know, you wanted to know what's the fix here, and that's what everyone wants to get to. But I really think the fix is robust auditing with paper ballot marking devices for the disabled and much, much, much more citizen oversight and participation. And you can only have that with transparent procedures. Kathy Dent in Sarasota wanted to outsource the recount to election systems and software. I mean, it's just gone too far. We need to reclaim our democracy. We need to reclaim our elections. And that might mean us rolling up our sleeves and becoming involved. So it's not an easy answer, but it's an important one.
That was Holly Jacobson, co-founder and co-director of the group Voter Action. Contact Voter Action by calling area code 206-723-1941 or visit the group's website at www.voteraction.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Belinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.